I will start with the less serious matter and proceed. The auditorium PM congregation is rescheduling its monthly Kaffeeklatsch to be held tomorrow, which is the 14th of March, from 1 to 2 p.m. before Sabbath services. I have before me here the Hebrew calendar for this present century. As I flip to 1981, I notice that the 20th, or next Friday, happens to be the 14th day of Adar. And there is a book in the Bible describing the background of that event. Since next Friday falls after that, I thought it would be appropriate, since this was the occasion that I was assigned, for us to go over again at an interesting period in time, just about one month before the Passover season, to discuss one of those most critical periods in the history of the Jews, those people who have preserved the Hebrew Bible and made it possible for the Messiah to come in the flesh in the days of Herod. Because the story behind this festival that we call Purim, which occurs on the 14th of the month Adar, or second Adar should there be an extra month, is the story of the book of Esther. Now, Esther's setting, of course, is in connection with such books as Daniel and Ezra and Nehemiah. You get the general feeling. I have before me here the English translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, and from time to time I might like to turn to read that, which I most often have read when we have gone through the material. In this case, however, I should like to do something just a bit different. There are different translations, and one that might be of some help to you is the one on the Book of Esther in the Anchor Bible Series, A-N-C-H-O-R. The Anchor Bible Series is published by Doubleday and Company, and each basic book, or with the Psalms, there's more than one book, is done by a separate author. This introduction, translation, and notes is by Carrie A. Moore, M-O-O-R-E. I'm not recommending the series as such. I wouldn't use some of the series, but this particular one is very interesting, and I was impressed with the way it is presented. We are dealing here with a book in the Bible. We're dealing here with a custom established in the book for the house of Judah that preserved this book. We are dealing with a matter here that is very similar to the way perhaps our church members, our brethren in England, might deal with the question of Thanksgiving in the United States. We have never asked the rest of the members of the Church of God to involve themselves in adopting a custom that in America we call the Day of Thanksgiving. There are probably two reasons. One, we have no authority to do so, and two, they don't have quite as much to be thankful for in a physical way in many countries, especially when you know how they live, with respect to financial poverty, the lack of food available at the kind of costs that we have here. No nation has ever eaten so much so cheaply as we can, and eat so well as we could, notice the change of the verb, in the United States. We gave some eggs from our chickens to someone who was not normally aware of chickens that live on a farm. And when they were prepared for this man, he wondered what had happened, because they did not look like the sick eggs he was used to. So we do have reasons to be thankful, and the Jews have reasons to be very, very thankful. We, perhaps in Thanksgiving, for the physical blessings we have, the Jews for even their life. For if God had not intervened, according to the book of Esther, there would be no house of Judah. there would not have been anyone born of either the tribe of Judah or the family of David. There would have been no Old Testament scriptures preserved. So what we should do is take a little look at this book in the short period of time we have and take some thoughts. I'm going to do it a little differently. I will try to pose some of the problems that people have raised. We're not going to go through the book verse by verse this evening, but take it from a distance as time permits and discuss certain parts of it and give you a background and a setting. The Anchor Bible Series is a kind of Bible translation in very modern format done by some of the best minds dealing with linguistics, and a commentary with an introduction and notes. Now, I don't normally recommend commentaries in reading the Bible. I used to use them before I came to Ambassador College. I used them sometimes afterward, but the longer you read the Bible, the longer you are in the church, the more often you find that what is in the commentary you could have figured out yourself. And the very thing you were looking for is what's missing. Nevertheless, there are certain kinds of commentaries. Now, in this case, the book of Esther is one of the simpler books of the Bible, but it is also one that is especially enhanced for the simple reason that its time setting in the Persian period is near enough that we have contemporary literature in part, as well as the possibility of literature that can provide further meaning to names, to words that might have been obscure, as well as, of course, any possible archaeological evidence, because we have cities, palaces named that have been discovered and excavated. The normal place to start reading in a book, as you know, is the beginning. And on that basis, we will turn to the last chapter. That way, we'll better understand the beginning. This is one of the things you will all learn, or should learn if you go to college, that it sometimes pays to look at the end of the book. And if you like the conclusion, you may find it worth buying or reading. What questions the man asks at the beginning may be very interesting. The conclusions he comes to at the end may have made the work fruitless. So let us look at the close, because here is a very interesting way of approaching the book. Now, King Xerxes, and I will read this translation, and you should follow in others. Now, King Xerxes, and I won't give any comment here as to why the name is Xerxes, but that is certainly the correct modern name, modern usage, because the king Ahasuerus is without any question Xerxes. Now, King Xerxes leveled taxes, very modern thought, on both the mainland, that's Asia proper, and the islands, many of which were, of course, settled by the Greeks. But as for all the achievements and the might of King Xerxes, as well as for an exact account of the influence of Mordecai, whom the king had promoted, is not all this recorded in the annals of the kings of Media and Persia? And in this copy, it is very clearly stated, annals of the kings of Media and Persia is in italics. That means it is the title of an official record or document that we would call the form of annals. For Mordecai the Jew ranked next to King Xerxes and was influential among the Jews and acceptable to the mass of his own countrymen. Now, when it says acceptable to the mass of his own countrymen, you can always guess that there were a few jealous souls. He sought the best interests of his people and was concerned for the welfare of his kinsmen. Why I wanted to read this, which is really the conclusion of the book, is that it sets the tone and character. For there are people who have assumed Esther was, let's say, the story of the 1002nd night. If you know the Arabian traditions of 1001, this was merely another one. The Jewish tradition would indicate clearly that the record could have been verified. That is, it is written with an appeal to further documentation if you would like to know the rest of the story, which need not have been part of Scripture, but might have been informative. And so the implication is, from the last chapter, that we should see in this work not a story, not a tale, but a documentation of a series of very significant events that led to the delivery of the Jewish nation from an enemy that sought in the days of Xerxes to destroy them. With this in mind and this kind of background, I'd like to read a little bit of the introduction, or spots from the introduction here. First of all, you might like to know what the first Protestant thought about the book of Esther. His name is Martin. You know Brother Martin? I mean Martin Luther. He voiced his sentiments when he said, "I could wish that the book of Esther did not exist at all, for it Judaizes too greatly and has much pagan impropriety." I thought you should know what the Protestants first thought of this book. It gives you an idea of why Protestants since have attacked the Bible as they have. Because Protestantism developed from the mind of a man who did not see in James anything more than the book of straw, or in Esther too much Judaizing. It will give you an idea of why Protestants approach the Bible as they do. I will flip through a few comments here. There are additions, of course, in the Latin Vulgate, the Septuagint and the Greek, or let's say the Catholic Bibles in English, additions to the Greek Bible. Sorry, yeah, that's true, but to the book of Esther. The remarkable thing, of course, is that all of these editions give clear evidence of fitting into the Greek translation and, in fact, basically originating in Greek rather than being translations from the Hebrew. So we are not concerned, because even scholars themselves are aware that these editions don't rank with Scripture. In the Catholic Bible, Esther is a canonical book. And the additions to Esther are really deuterocanonical. That is, they admittedly don't have quite the same rank. They were derived from the Greeks who wanted to include Mordecai's prayer, who wanted to include Esther's prayer, as if that would have been recorded, or as if either of them might have remembered the words. But there are people who like to embellish. The question of the authority of Esther, or as a book of canon, was without any question settled when in the AD 90s the Jewish Council of Jamnia clearly pronounced Esther, among other books, a part of Scripture. Now, it was not that the Bible for the first time in Hebrew was declared canonical, but this council was held at a time when the question really was, should any other works, either Hebrew, Aramaic, or Greek, that had been circulating in the Jewish sectarian community, meaning the churches of God, be a part of Scripture? And the New Testament was, at that council, rejected by the Jewish nation. But at the same time, they did clearly put their approval on that which had been written in Hebrew and or Aramaic prior to the time of Herod. In other words, we're going back to the what we would call the Old Testament period. Studies on the process of canonization, says one of the notes here, have confirmed the observation of a scholar who has gone into this and shown that the decisions of the Pharisee, that is the Pharisaic school at Jamnia, was unofficial and only gradually became accepted throughout Judaism. Now, I have said that indeed it pronounced it canonical. What we are saying is that there were people in the Jewish community that did not recognize the Pharisees as having authority. Now I can show you in Matthew 23:1, Jesus said, the scribes and Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. The Sadducees didn't agree, and there were others who didn't agree. But Jesus recognized that the decisions they made were official and right. And even though it was regarded by many in the Jewish community as unofficial, Jesus himself puts his approval on such a decision because he said they sat in Moses' seat and had authority to make a decision with respect to the Bible that had been committed to them. The New Testament had not been committed to them, and their decision on that has no bearing because they had refused its speaker in the first place and were responsible for his death. But in any case, it is interesting that the Jewish nation, whether they thought it was official or not, in the end was forced to recognize the book of Esther as a part of Scripture. Now there were sectarians like the Essenes who have preserved copies, unintentionally of course, of the Bible, which they buried in the caves at the area of the Dead Sea when the Romans of course came through the region. The one book that is not there is the book of Esther. We do not follow the Essenes. And it is very probably influence of those and others that accounts for the absence of the book among some Jews. Questions that arose in the eastern area of the Roman Empire among Christians about it, even though most Christians recognized that the book of Esther was a part of the standard Old Testament. It is clearly included in the Talmudic statements regarding the books of the Bible. There is no doubt that Josephus regarded it as canonical, our commentator here says. Josephus himself regarded Esther as canonical, for he certainly paraphrased it in Jewish Antiquities, book 11. Josephus was a priest. He was a Pharisee. Josephus names the books of the Bible in number. He says there were 22, in which case he is clearly linking two of the smaller books, undoubtedly different than from the King James order, but the number of 22, as we would view it, is clearly indicating that Esther is a part of the whole story. But there have been those who have questioned it unwisely. Interestingly enough, the whole Western Christian world in North Africa and in Italy and much of Greece, for instance in Cyprus and in Palestine and Syria, all recognized it. The only questions essentially arose in some areas of Asia Minor in the East. Anyway, it is interesting to see that it is possible to have a conviction on this matter that is essentially sound when you realize a man in the days of the apostles, Josephus, a priest, who in a sense represents the family of Aaron, should have used the book in a manner that is without doubt canonical. All of the standard forms of the Jewish translations, I should say the Jewish copies of the Bible in Hebrew would have it. The book of Esther is a remarkable work, the like of which is found nowhere else in Scripture. I'd like you to listen to a few statements that are made because they're very interesting as a scholarly mind, a religious mind, looks at the book. On the face of it, says Mr. Moore, or Dr. Moore, the story in Esther seems to be true. That's comforting. Nothing in the book seems improbable, let alone unbelievable. The picture of the king, Xerxes, seems to be quite compatible with what we know of him from other literary and archaeological sources. Now, he does say there are a few questions that you might find arising in the story. We'll note them from time to time. I'm moving through the pages and I open up to a map. And it might be good for you to realize that Susa, where the events took place, was not the great palace in modern Persia at Persepolis, but was really in the area of Elam, ancient Elam, and slightly to the northeast of Babylon, just on the other side of the Tigris. In a sense, the palace of Susa, where the story takes place, was very near Babylon in contrast to the capital in Persia itself. And it represents what we might call the center of the empire. Susa was as far east from Sardis, from Miletus in Western Asia Minor, as it was west from the Persian cities of Kabul and the Indus River. You know, Persia at that time ruled all the way from Ethiopia to India and, of course, to the Greek Isles. The time setting, without any question, can be determined readily. We will look at the Bible itself for the information. Just a little background on Xerxes. He was the son of Darius. Darius, who gave permission to Zerubbabel, of course, to build and finalize the second temple. And he was the son of Queen Atossa, who was the daughter of Cyrus. So he was, in that sense, the grandson of Cyrus the Great, who authorized initially the restoration of the Jewish community. This was a remarkable family. Darius was quite upset with those who revolted at the beginning of his reign. He was a man of unusual temperament, and we will see that when the story develops. He was a devout worshiper of Ahura Mazda, which has to do, of course, with the Zoroastrian religion, the sun. He did prohibit the worship of demons in his realm. So he did have an unusual perspective. He warred with the Greeks for the early part of his reign, and for the last 13 spent most of his time developing the internal greatness of the realm. Xerxes was assassinated in his bedroom by a conspiracy led by his uncle Artabanus and his grandson. And he was buried in a magnificent royal sepulcher in Persia near the major capital. Now, one thing our author brings out that should be of interest to you. Xerxes had a winter palace at Susa. You obviously wouldn't go there for the summer. Many kings have a summer palace in the mountains and a winter palace in the valley. That way they have a more even temperature. The author of Esther shows awareness of certain features of the Persian government, such as the seven princely advisors, chapter 1, verse 14, the efficient postal system, which of course you will recognize in chapters 3 and 8. He is also familiar with certain practices of the Persian court life, including doing obeisance to the king's high officials, which Mordecai didn't do, and the recording and rewarding of the king's benefactors. The author is aware of various details and Persian customs, among them hanging as a form of capital punishment, the observation of lucky days, royal horses with crowns, chapter 6, verse 8, eating while reclined on couches, chapter 7, verse 8, and the headpiece known as the turban, chapter 8, verse 15. Some of these things are lost in the King James Version. You'd think they were wearing Henry VIII's crown in that day instead of turbans, which they did wear. And finally, the author uses a number of Persian nouns, including a number that I won't read to you, but a clear recognition of the impact of the Persian language and what they now recognize, and which they have for a long time, even those who thought that Esther was written in the 2nd century B.C. or later. There is no use anywhere in the whole of the book of Esther of any word derived from Greek, which clearly indicates that the book of Esther was written before the time of Alexander the Great, and in reality goes back to the Persian period. The author here, the translator, points up it has been overlooked, has simply been neglected because people didn't want the book to be written basically in the period when it was written. There's no doubt that most of the personal names found in the book are of Iranian origin. Now the story, and you grant, of course, here that the man takes an ambivalent view. He says the story does have some very improbable things. A festival lasting 180 days. Now we're going to look at this and see whether it was so improbable, but I want you to remember that the 10th chapter said you could verify it if you wanted to check the records. And then, of course, there's Vashti's refusal to obey the king's command. Now, from the point of view of the author, no queen would do this. I don't think the author was very observant of the contemporary world. The king's ridiculous letter ordering all men throughout the empire to be masters in their own homes. I will not comment on that ridiculous statement. The appointment of non-Persians to the all-important post of prime minister, which Mordecai held. The letters sent out in all languages of the empire instead of Aramaic, the official language. Maybe if you understood in the first place that Haman intended everybody to hear in his own language, then there wouldn't be such a problem. If the king had done it, it might only have been in Aramaic. And then there is the king's permission for an entire people within his empire to wipe out their possessions, to be wiped out, and their possessions plundered. That's his permission to Haman in the first place. It's thought to be improbable. But when we see what Hitler did or intended to do in the Second World War, it is not improbable that there are men who do try to extirpate other people. If you know what happened in the Soviet Union to some of the minority peoples in the Caucasus, you would understand after the Second World War that there are people who do intend to wipe others off the face of the earth. And then there is the king's sanction of fighting everywhere, even within the palace complex itself, to get rid of the king's, the Jews' enemies. Now, though improbable, he says, of these things, these may, of course, still have been true. Which is the same as saying he doesn't know one way or another. That there is really no evidence because we don't have those annals at this moment to verify or to disprove. But at least I think it's good for you to know that it is possible to have a man who was chosen in the scholarly world to make a very good translation, a very respectable presentation of this book, who can still admit that though these things seem most improbable, they still could be true. Now the question is, do you rely on your own judgment, your own authority, or whom do you rely on for making decisions in matters like this? Now there are some discrepancies or contradictions. For instance, there are 127 provinces in the empire, in contrast to what Herodotus says, that there were 20 satrapies. The question, of course, immediately is, which our author will show later, that Herodotus was not describing provinces. He was describing an area that is called a satrap. Then there is Esther's arrival at the court of Susa. In 480 B.C., that is chapter 2, verse 16, a time when, according to Herodotus, Xerxes would still have been away fighting in Greece. Now, we want to check to see whether this man interpreted Esther correctly. Other contradictions are of a more serious nature. According to the verses here in chapter 2 and 3, Esther was queen between the 7th and 12th years of Xerxes' reign. But according to Herodotus, Amestris was queen. Moreover, according to Herodotus, Persian queens had to come from one of seven noble Persian families, a custom which would have automatically ruled out an insignificant Jewess. But we'll look at the answers to that too. It's good for you to know how these people think, and to what extent they are only thinking. Josephus knew the festival of Purim well, which is to say that he must also have, of course, known the book of Esther. There have been many questions as to what the word Pur means, but it has been clearly established that the Assyrian Puru, a stone or a lot, is a proper meaning. Then there is the Babylonian Puru that now has been confirmed to mean lot, and secondarily fate. The form Purim is a Hebraized form of a Babylonian word. So there is no basic question as to the usage of such terms. The festival was named after the festival, after the lots that were cast. Now, we don't use lots today. It's like putting, let's say, little strips of paper or maybe something of another form, like stones in a basket or a hat, and, you know, pulling out blindly to find which one has been approved or what should the answer be. That's a rather past custom, although on occasion there are cultures that use it, and within our society, I suppose, it is not done uncommonly in lodges. There have been questions as to whether the book of Esther was invented to justify the Jews adopting a pagan festival, but there's no basis for it that can be established. You see, they think this way because they know Christians have justified Easter and Christmas, and they make even a note to that effect. And they say, well, if we, you know, can tolerate Christmas, we see no reason why the Jews might not have had liberty to Judaize a pagan festival. Then there is, of course, the problem that the story of Vashti seems more like fiction than fact, so much like a Thousand and One Nights tales. But on the other hand, maybe the Thousand and One Nights were based on a lot of experience in the desert world. Significant for purposes of dating the book of Esther is the fact that the book of Chronicles contains no Greek words, and also has a style of Hebrew so very similar to Esther. And Chronicles, without a doubt in Jewish tradition, is attributed to Ezra. Ezra was essentially a contemporary, though he comes on the scene approximately a decade and a half to two decades later. I won't go through the more details on that, but I've already commented, I think, sufficiently. Now we come to the story itself. And so I will read sections of it and then comment and move along as we have time. It was in the days of Xerxes. Now a footnote tells us very clearly that the Hebrew must be understood and without a question should be understood as the name that we know in our English language as Xerxes the king, Xerxes the first, Xerxes the great. The Hebrew Ahasuerus meant this man can now be sufficiently established, which of course could have been known and was known. But there are always people who doubt. That we can be sure ourselves without any further question. This is the Xerxes who used to reign from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. Now here we have an important note to the fact, and there will be footnotes, and then there will be the basic area of notes. And I will turn to that on occasion now, because I think it important to take note. The Hebrew word translated provinces does not mean a satrap, and therefore, because Herodotus says there were far fewer satraps or satrapies than the book of Esther says provinces, we're simply dealing with two different things. Despite scholarly speculation, no satisfactory explanation exists for the particular number of provinces given here. That is, we have no record one way or another. It is very probable that the provinces were essentially the varied and numerous ethnic elements in the empire that Herodotus mentions. But the satrapies were the areas of government. So we have not here a contradiction, but in fact, very probably, if we were to think it through, an amplification of information found nowhere else in the Persian or Greek realm. Now there is a problem with the first words in this book. Literally it says, "And it came to pass." Now the problem is that this introduction is used for such books as Joshua, Judges, and 1 and 2 Samuel. And all of those are historic books. Therefore, we're frustrated by the fact that the book of Esther claims to be historic. That's the problem, you see, they first deal with. But we are relieved to know that the book of Jonah starts this way too. And you know that's a story. And therefore, we really should translate it once upon a time. I'm glad he translated it much more like it was in the days of Xerxes, not once upon a time. But you see, these are the way these men look at a book like this. And when you look at other places in the Bible, you realize that the intent is clearly to establish a factual background. At that time, when King Xerxes sat on his royal throne in the Acropolis of Susa, and the translation Acropolis is a modern way, it has the sense of the fortified palace area. He gave a banquet in the third year of his reign for all his officials and courtiers. I'm going to read his translation. The officers of the army of Persia and Media, the nobles and the rulers of the province who were present, and displayed the great wealth of his empire and the glorious splendor of his majesty for many days, in parentheses, for half a year. Now, of course, the Bible says it was essentially 6 months or 180 days. Now, here's the problem. It's not a problem, but I'll state the problem. There were his officials, his courtiers, the officials of the army, the nobles, and the rulers. Now, for practical purposes, there's no question you could easily have taken care of their needs in far less than 180 days. So when it says the officials of the army, the nobles, and all of these, there's no reason to think it should have taken that long. But let us look to see what the Hebrew says. Now I will turn to the Hebrew, and then I will show you what he has done and what he's taken for granted. In verse 3, he gave a banquet in the third year of his reign for all his officials and courtiers. You don't have to have that very long. That is, to all his princes and his servants. Then our translator, taking from the Septuagint, says, the officers of the army of Persia and Media. Now, you know there are not that many officers. And if all the king was doing was giving a banquet to the officers, there was no reason for the 180 days. That's why he says that makes so much nonsense, too long a time. But now listen to the Hebrew. It was in the third year he made a feast to all his princes and his servants. The army of Persia and Media, not the officers of the army, but the army itself, the nobles, the princes of the provinces being before him. This clearly indicates that we should understand the duration of time because the king threw a banquet and wanted the officers, the princes, the nobles, and in fact, the entire army to see his palace. And he had them go through increment by increment over a 6 month time. Now they say the Hebrew couldn't be right because it says army and not the officers. And they just assume that has to be there because they can't imagine the king doing something like this. But if indeed the king is showing his palace, and he was wont to show a lot of his things, he was rather ostentatious, then the translation of army without officers, which doesn't exist in the Hebrew, and the 180 days, or 80 days, as this translation is not incompatible. That is, it is reasonable. Because when you have an army like this and have them entertained and come through and see the palace, knowing the size of those armies, 6 months is not unreasonable. And these would probably, without doubt, be the area of autumn through winter. That is somewhere October, November, December, January, February, March. That's the cool half of the year. And so he displayed this great wealth. Now, when it was all over, the king gave a week-long party for all the men staying in the Acropolis of Susa, for both the important and unimportant alike, who really had spent their time helping him throw this lengthy occasion. And the courtyard was decorated with white and violet cotton curtains, which were fastened by linen and purple cords to silver rings and marble columns. And couches of gold and silver were on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and colored stones. And drinks were served in gold goblets, not any two alike. And there was a plenty of royal wine, as befitted a king. And the drinking, of course, was according to law. You drank when the king drank, except that no one was constrained as far as the quantity he should take. For the king had ordered all the palace waiters to serve each guest as he wished. You see, the Gentile nation started with the kingdom of gold. Then there was the kingdom of silver. Then there was the kingdom of bronze, and then iron, and then iron and clay. And we're in the world of clay. There's quite a difference here. Queen Vashti, too, gave a party for the women in the royal house of King Xerxes. Now, our story here, just by way of setting, it says that this was in the third year. And this would be in the period of time, and we should verify it and look it up. I like to tell you how to find things like this. This happens to be the Babylonian chronology, 626 BC to AD 75. And I'll flip to the reign of Xerxes. And here we have, in this remarkable work done by Parker and Duberstein, the reign of Xerxes. Year one of his reign began with the 6th of April, 485. So the third year would be the year 483 to 482 BC. Our bookstore could get this for you. This gives you, in fact, the Babylonian calendar, month by month, showing all the 13 months as they have been found. That is, every time a year had 13 months. You might be interested in the fact that it goes to the Seleucid period. It even comes, for instance, to AD 31. And if you look at AD 31, you will discover that the month of Nisan starts on April 12. And the 14th would therefore be a Wednesday, the 25th. The Seventh-day Adventists would like it to be 1 month earlier. I am pleased to say the Babylonians knew better. So we'll now move along. I won't tell you the story, except that Vashti did not obey her husband's, the royal command, and you remember the rest of it. The king was quite displeased, and it was decided that he should write a decree, which is described in these terms. If it please the king, let such and such be written. Then when the king's decree, which he has proclaimed, is heard throughout the realm, all women, regardless of their status, shall show proper respect to their husbands. That's why it was the kingdom of silver, as distinct from clay. Today we have clay brains making decisions in society. I will now move along, having been upset by this modern society on that point. Sometime later, after the king had put Vashti away, his anger was subsided, and he remembered Vashti. That is, he recalled what a nice woman she was, but he couldn't reverse his decision. And when he perhaps commented about missing her, the king's pages said, "Let beautiful young virgins be selected for the king. Now, in that day, it didn't seem to be a problem. And let the king appoint commissioners in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather together every beautiful young virgin to the Acropolis of Susa, to the harem under the authority of Haggai, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the women, and let him give them their beauty treatment. Now that does sound modern. Then let the girl who most pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti. Now in the first place, let us say, so we don't forget it because I may not have time to go back. Herodotus wrote, essentially, a quarter to a half century later. He lived in the days of the successor. What Herodotus may record, I regard with respect. Herodotus said, I am bound to report and record what I have heard, but that does not mean that I believe everything that I report. In any case, it does not seem improbable that what he reported of the queen, who was another woman and not Vashti, is not improbable when you realize that Solomon had 700 queens. Modern scholars simply try to make arguments and issues where none need exist. Kings such as this who had harems had numerous queens. Whether certain queens had to come from the seven noble families, as Herodotus says, is irrelevant for the simple reason that in a harem there were far more than just the daughters of those families. In this case, Esther replaced Vashti. Esther didn't replace some other woman. That's what the Bible says. And there's no reason to assume there was only one queen when the term itself is equivalent to the wife of a king, and a king who had more than one wife had more than one queen. Be that as it may, the advice was followed. Now there was in the Acropolis of Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai. He was the son ultimately of Kish, a Benjamite. And here, of course, is a problem. Who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the exiles who had been deported with Jeconiah, king of Judah, that is Jehoiakim, when Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had taken them into exile? The question then is, was Mordecai really this old? Very likely, if this exile, which occurred in 597, is the case, then we simply have an indication that he was an infant at the time. The Hebrew has who had been carried away, and it most certainly must refer to, as they think, Mordecai. But in reality, we simply cannot be sure. We know it does not refer to Kish, because that would be going back, you see, to Kish, who was the ancestor of Saul. So this goes back to that royal line. But whether Mordecai was an infant and now a very old man, or whether it is in reference to one of his immediate ancestors, we simply cannot determine from the text. But the implication, just grammatically, would imply it was Mordecai himself. Now, he had adopted his cousin, who meant that she was the daughter of a relative of his. His cousin Hadassah. That word means myrtle in Hebrew. That's the one we know as Esther, which is the Persian name or star, since she had neither mother or father. So the implication is that if her mother or father died, that probably her mother was already rather older, and Hadassah was the youngest child. And it is very possible, of course, that even her parents were younger than Mordecai. But in any case, she was still a girl and a virgin, that is, a young woman. She was shapely and had a beautiful face. Now her father and mother had died, and Mordecai had adopted her. It's just possible that Mordecai was an old, old man. But one of those unusually able, surviving old men that we sometimes read of in the business world, who go to work at 92, go to work at 94. And I recently was reading the story of a man who goes to work and runs his business at 99. Later on, when the king's edict was promulgated, and when many young girls were brought to the Acropolis of Susa, Esther was also taken to the palace. Now we won't go into all of these details here. The girl pleased her superior and gained his support, so that he promptly gave her her beauty treatment and her delicacies, and he provided her with the 7 special maids from the palace and transferred her and her maids to the best quarters of the harem. Esther had not said anything about her origins because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. She was of the house of Benjamin. Therefore, if there was the Jewish look that Haman and others saw in the house of Judah, he simply didn't spot it in Esther and didn't guess the story. But Mordecai used to walk about in front of the court of the harem so as to find out about Esther's well-being and progress. And you know, of course, that she did please the king. After 12 months' treatment with oil of myrrh and perfumes and cosmetics for women and whatever seemed necessary, why her superior provided. Now it's very interesting how the story develops here. Esther had charmed all who saw her, the end of verse 15. So when Esther was taken to King Xerxes to his royal apartment, that is in the 10th month, which is Tebet, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all his other wives, and more than all the other girls, she won his favor and devotion, so that he placed the royal turban on her head and made her queen in place of Vashti. And now we will look at the Jewish translation, just so we have the story here, in verse 16 of chapter 2. So Esther was taken to the king Ahasuerus, into his house royal, in the 10th month, which is the month Tebet, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the 7th year of his reign would be 479 to 478. So we'll just look at that here so we get the picture clear and see if there was any need of a contradiction, as our author said that he should have been fighting the Greeks. Now, if we are dealing with the month Tebet, this is clearly defined as the 10th month. And so we look at the story, the 10th month along the way would have begun in December 22, in 479 BC. In December 22. And if it is in the 10th month, then in all likelihood we would say it is somewhere at the end of December or in January. And if it is in January, it is 478. In any case, the battle with the Greeks did not take place so late in the year 479, and the implication is that one of the earliest things the king did after the battle was to return and to find a replacement for Queen Vashti. So the fact that it is the 10th month, and that's the end of December or in January, would seem to provide absolutely no contradiction. It just is an issue that was made needlessly. It fits perfectly with the story that the king himself had returned in his 7th year following the debacle when he attempted to subdue the Greeks in the Greek Isles but failed. We will now proceed with a few comments here. Mordecai. It's a good Babylonian name. Mordecai is the Hebraized form of Marduka, which is ultimately derived from Marduk. but that's the name that he was given by the Persians, who adopted many of these Babylonian names. Then it points up that Hadassah clearly is defined as myrtle in the Jewish literature, the Targums, without any question. Nor does our author think the problem he first introduced, that this was a Jewish woman, presents a difficulty. There is, of course, no great difficulty in believing that a Jewish girl could be part of a Persian king's harem. When it came to foreign wives, kings could be quite broad-minded. I would remind you, however, that he married her before he knew who she was. And as far as he knew, she was Persian, even if she didn't descend from any of the seven noble families. So, in a sense, many of these arguments are irrelevant. I did like his argument, though, that she apparently didn't observe all the laws of kosher. Then her Jewishness would have been perceived. The implication is she did eat her meat and drank her milk at the same time, which is what the Church of God does, rather than the Jewish custom, as you know. And I think that's an important point. I want to read just a note here in verse 14 of the second chapter, just to give you an idea of something you might spot on occasion. She went, each one whom Xerxes checked out, went in the evening, and in the next morning she returned to the second harem, to the custody of Shashgaz. Now, apparently the king had, in fact, a harem in the following structure. Here, as in so many other places, it is a question of how best to translate it. The Hebrew would imply the second harem, but in what sense, you see, is the question. The reading adopted here understands the second harem to mean either a second group of women, that is, the concubines, or a separate wing in the harem complex. This interpretation is all the more plausible because the second harem was under someone else's supervision than the one who actually supervised Esther first. So it probably was, in fact, both a second group of women, that is, certain women went into the second harem, and it was another wing of his palace. And they perhaps would have played the role of concubines rather than having the royal title, as ultimately was bestowed on some who remained in the other wing of the palace. God did not forbid polygamy. He says clearly that any man who has more than one wife will love one and not the other in the same way. But in a world that slaughtered tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of men, God permitted polygamy as a better solution than prostitution. Therefore, men who were able and financial took care of women who simply could never have had husbands and would have had to enter into some kind of slavery otherwise. You read the story of the battles, they were wars of attrition. And that's one of the fundamental reasons why polygamy even existed. It makes no sense in a society where there is essentially an even population. There was a plot against the king. This is in chapter 2, verses 19 to 23. It was discovered by Mordecai. Mordecai reveals it to Esther. Esther told the king. It was investigated, verse 23. Its existence confirmed. The two conspirators were hanged on the gallows, and the whole affair was recorded in the daily record in the king's presence. That's a nice, effective modern translation. We don't have any of these records. Whether some of them were buried with the kings, like copies of the Bible might have been buried with the kings of Judah, remains to be seen. Sometime later on, King Xerxes promoted Haman, chapter 3, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, that is, he descended from the Amalekites, advancing him and making him the prime minister. So all the king's servants at the king's gate used to bow down and prostrate themselves, for that is what the king had commanded to be done to him.
Now Mordecai, however, would never bow down and prostrate himself. So the king's servant at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Now prostration is quite different from what Mr. Armstrong said. If you kneel out of respect on one knee, and when the supreme patriarch of Buddhism came to the campus, the monk stood with him, other Thais knelt with two knees, and I knelt on one knee, as the picture shows. That is still the permissible custom of the Church of God, even though there were a few critics. So finally, when they had spoken to him day after day and he had not listened to them, then they informed Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's conduct would be tolerated. For he had confided in them that he was a Jew, and that wasn't permitted. That is, his religion simply wouldn't allow him to prostrate himself, which is a form of worship. When Haman had seen for himself that Mordecai did not bow down or prostrate himself, he was furious. But he hated to kill just Mordecai, for they had told him who Mordecai's people were. And so Haman sought to wipe out all the Jews throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes, along with Mordecai. Now, is it reasonable? I cite World War II as a simple illustration. Go ask some of the people who lived in the Caucasus in the days of Stalin whether such a thing is possible. In the first month, which is the month Nisan, of the 12th year of Xerxes, the lot was cast in Haman's presence. Literally, it says, and very nicely here, the poor, that is, the lot, P-U-R, was cast in Haman's presence to determine the day of the month. Now we'll read the 7th verse of chapter 3 from the Jewish translation. In the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day, and from month to month to the 12th month, which is the month Adar. And in that way, it would enable them to determine what month and what day of the month. You see, why did they have to cast from month to month to the 12th month? Because in the end, it was the 12th month which was the one. When the first month came down, when the second month came down, there was no indication they should choose it. Not until the 12th month came down did the answer come up, yes, this is the month. And then in that month they waited, and from day to day to day. And when it came to the 13th day of the 12th month, it was decided that this was the month and this was the day that it should occur. But of course it didn't occur that year. They simply think that the Jewish translation is incorrect. I'm sorry, the Jewish original, the Hebrew original, and they have rendered it differently here. They think it's some mistake. But when you know what a lot is, you realize that if it's going to fall in the 12th month, that he cast a lot for each month and to see in that month whether that was the month that should be chosen. There's nothing wrong with the Jewish translation. It's just the way people think of the problem. And so we read, Haman went to Xerxes, verse 8. Now there is a certain people scattered, yet unassimilated. Now look at these arguments. We won't read very much of the book, but I just want to hit the highlights. There is a people yet unassimilated among peoples throughout the province of your kingdom whose statutes are different from every other people's. Now others may be different, but they all get along with each other and they tolerate each other's customs. And they don't raise waves. But there is a people that thinks itself superior, that's unassimilated. That was his argument. Who hold views different and in opposition to others. They don't observe even the king's statutes. Therefore, it is not appropriate for the king to tolerate them. Now, if it please the king, let it be recorded that they be destroyed. Now the implication is the king may have known more about Jews and Haman was taking no chances. So he decided not to tip his hand about who they were. And I will pay 10,000 silver talents to the proper officials to deposit in the king's treasury, just so we could do this to safeguard your realm. And the king was very impressed with Haman. He had been very successful in handling his office. So he took off his signet ring from off his hand and gave it to Haman, the enemy of the Jews. "Well, it's your money," said the king to Haman. "Do what you like with the people." Now we talk about dictators. This man was far from a dictator. He was influenced first by Haman and then by Vashti. Or as the commentator said here, the interesting thing is the king Xerxes had a wife who first wouldn't obey him, and then he exchanged her for Esther, and he was overpowered by her. So he was easily influenced by others. And he wasn't even that interested in the money. He said, "Look, it's your money, Haman. Do what you like with the people. You're really handling so much of the office here and doing so well." So the king's secretaries were summoned on the 13th day of the first month. That's 1 year later. They thought it was just right, you see, to do it on the 13th day. So everything they wanted to do was the 13th. Was very lucky. And the edict was written exactly as Haman had dictated to the king's satraps, the governors of every province. So here we discover that governors were over the province and the satraps were over the satrapies. They were not the same divisions. And the officials of every people. It is written to each province in its own script, to each people in its own language, in the name of King Xerxes, and it was sealed with a royal signet ring. Dispatchers were sent out by couriers to all the king's provinces to wipe out, slaughter, annihilate all the Jews, men and boys, women and children, in a single day. On the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar. Now, when you see, of course, that this had occurred in the 12th year, then these events were to take place in which year? The 13th. It was to be the 13th year of the king, the 12th month, and the 13th day. Now, of course, we might take note. I don't know where the 13th came from in the Roman world or the modern world, but it looks like, at least from a biblical point of view, if you want to find origins of things, that what was once a lucky day, or so Haman thought, turned out to be very unlucky. The contents of the documents were to be promulgated in each province, published to all peoples, to be ready for that day. And they rushed throughout the realm. Then the king and Haman sat down to drink. The king seems to have loved to drink. The Persians had a rule. You made a decision when you were drunk, and afterward, when you were not drunk, if you came to the same conclusion, they knew it was right. That is Herodotus's evaluation, and it fits very well here in the picture. We'll move along. Mordecai learned of everything that had been done. He tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes. He went out into the midst of the city and wailed bitterly, because he was a Jew and they knew it. And then he came as far as the king's gate, for no one in sackcloth was allowed to enter the king's gate. And in every province where the king's command was heard, there was loud mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and wailing. Most of them were lying in sackcloth and ashes. You know, it is unfortunate that that didn't happen in 1933. If the Jewish communities in Europe had fasted and wept and wailed and laid in sackcloth and ashes, or lay in sackcloth and ashes, one would have to have concluded that Hitler would never have come to 1939. The reason the Jews escaped in the days of Xerxes is because they really sought God. These were the good figs. The bad figs were all removed. You remember Jeremiah's parable. When Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her, the queen was quite shocked. And she sent clothing for Mordecai to wear so that he could take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept it. So Esther summoned Hatak, one of the royal eunuchs whom the king had appointed to wait on her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn the full particulars of this behavior. So Hatak went out, and of course the queen herself learned. And finally, it was agreed that Mordecai and all the Jews and Queen Esther should fast. Go and gather all the Jews now in Susa and fast for me, said the queen. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, either day or night. And I and my maids will fast as you do. This is verse 15 of chapter 4. In this condition, while fasting, I'll go to the king, even though it's against the law to go without being summoned. And if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then left and carried out all Esther's instructions. Now, they were to fast for 3 days and three nights. There are people who take this verse to show that Jesus couldn't have been crucified on Wednesday and would not have risen on Saturday evening because 3 days and three nights don't mean 3 days and three nights. For we read, as the next chapter opens up, and so it was that on the third day Esther put on her royal robes. And they say that the third day here can't mean after 3 days, and I agree. It says very plainly, listen carefully what it says, we're going to fast 3 days, day and night. And the interesting thing, it says, in this condition of fasting. So it was on the third day of the fast. And this has nothing to do with after 3 days, but that's just the way people study these things. On the third day, while the fast was continuing, Esther put on her royal robes, stepped in the inner court of the palace opposite the royal apartment. The king was seated on his throne in the throne room facing the building's entrance. Finally, when the king noticed Queen Esther standing in the court, she won his favor. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter that he was holding. Then Esther came up and touched the tip of the scepter. The king then said, "What do you want?" Now, she was undoubtedly a remarkable woman, and she dressed to attract the attention of the king. And she, of course, had the presence of God's Spirit. Now, instead of giving an answer right away, when the king said, "Look, I could even divide the realm. You're so beautiful. You take half, and I'll keep the other half." I don't understand kings. But on the other hand, that's rather like California law, I must admit. "If it pleased the king," said Esther, "let the king come with Haman today to a dinner." And that was apparently that evening, the fast would have been over, "that I have prepared for him. Bring Haman right away," said the king, "so that we may do as Esther wants. I take it he'd like not only to drink, but to eat." Now, you know the rest of the story. We're drawing to a conclusion. And they had a wonderful occasion. But she didn't reveal what she wished, and they had another occasion. But before the other occasion occurred, the king couldn't sleep at night. Chapter 6, verse 1. And not being able to sleep, he wondered if something had been overlooked in his realm. And so he demanded that the records be read to see if there was a problem, that he had not been managing his affairs right. And then they read in the record of his reign and found the name Mordecai. And the king said, "Well, you know, what honor has been conferred on this Mordecai?" He realized something hadn't been done. And nothing has been done for him. And just as that was said, there was somebody out there in the court, and somebody asked, or the king asked, "Who's in the court?" Now, Haman had just entered the court, so the king's servants told him, "Well, Haman is waiting in the court," so the king said, "Let him enter." When Haman entered, the king's question right away was, What should be done for the man whom the king especially wants to honor? Now, Haman reasoned within himself, whom would the king especially want to honor besides me? So his problem was Haman. And then Haman said to the king, all right, have them bring, and then you know the story. He wanted even to be king because he wanted to be dressed in the original robes that the king wore at the coronation. And the king didn't mind that. He doesn't put on old robes again. So he said, fine, put them on Mordecai, and the man that I choose, that's Haman, that's you, you're going to lead him around the city to show the kind of honor I want to bestow on Mordecai. Now you can imagine when the king had finished with this and Haman went back to his family that his stomach was rather upset. And so it was, of course, that the king demanded that Haman come to the party on the second day. And so Queen Esther said, if I have obtained favor, your majesty, and if it please the king, chapter 6:7, verse 3, let my life be granted to me at my request. Still didn't betray the whole story. And my people's at my petition. Now nobody knew, not even Haman guessed she was a Jewess. For we have been sold, I and my people, for destruction, for slaughter and annihilation. This is the kind of hate this man has. If we had just been sold as slaves and servant girls, I would have kept quiet. For our problem would not have been worth bothering the king. Who is it? Exclaimed King Xerxes to Queen Esther. Where is he? And who has the nerve to do this? That's beautiful translation. And now Esther responds in like. An enemy, an adversary. And she points the finger, this wicked Haman here. I don't know who ate the meal, but Haman was dumbfounded before the king and queen. But when the king arose in anger from his wine, and you can imagine he had already had too much, you can't tell the king where to stop, and went out into the garden of the pavilion, Haman remained behind. Now, the king simply bolted the table and went out to think this thing through as to what ought to be done. And of course, you know, ultimately, that is in a few minutes, Haman was executed on the very gallows he proposed to execute Mordecai on. That same day, Xerxes gave Esther the entire estate of Haman. Chapter 8, 1, the enemy of the Jews. And when Mordecai was presented to the king, for Esther had disclosed to him their relationship, the king took off the signet ring, which he had recovered from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over Haman's estate. Then Esther spoke again to the king, collapsing at his feet and crying and begging him to frustrate the evil intention of Haman, because the document had gone out that the people were to destroy and annihilate the Jews. And now there had to be a decree issued to reverse it. And I'm going to read for the moment the Jewish translation, chapter 8, verse 9. Then were the king's scribes called at that time in the third month. Now we have documentation, the implication of the book of Esther. Even though some things may be dramatically unexpected, might even reach the carnal mind as if improbable, the implication is that we are dealing with documentation that you can check in the records. So the king's secretaries were summoned on the 23rd day of the third month, is this translation, which is the month Sivan, and the edict concerning the Jews was written exactly as Mordecai had dictated, that they should be free to deliver themselves. Further, that the people should offer themselves to the defense of the Jews. Read carefully verse 11, and so on. And on one day, the whole of the provinces were to come to the defense of the Jews, and the Jews themselves were to have the right to punish their enemies. On the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar. The contents of the edict were to be promulgated in each province. And again, it was in the languages of the people so that they might all know. The Jews celebrated the occasion of hearing the news that they could defend themselves. And chapter 9, verse 1, on the 13th day of the 12th month, this lucky day in the month Adar, when the king's commandment and edict were about to be enforced, on that day when the enemies of the Jews had hoped to destroy them, the opposite happened. The Jews destroyed their enemies. The Jews had gathered in their cities throughout King Xerxes' province to kill those who sought their ruin. No one, however, was successful against them, since everyone feared them. Moreover, all the provincial officers, satraps, governors, and those who conduct the king's affairs aided the Jews, for they feared Mordecai, who was prime minister. For Mordecai was very influential in the royal palace, and his reputation was spreading to all the provinces as the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. And of course, there are people who don't like Jews to exercise power. So the Jews defeated all their enemies. 500 men perished in the Acropolis of Susa itself. So the story goes on. The Jews in Susa had organized, and they had to do defense on 2 days, the 13th and the 14th. Otherwise, throughout the provinces, they only had to defend themselves on the 13th. And then they celebrated on the next day. That is why the Jewish villagers living in unwalled towns celebrate the 14th day of the month Adar on an occasion, as an occasion for rejoicing and feasting, for holiday making and exchanging delicacies. And then, of course, in the next chapter, we have the letter that went out authorizing that this custom should now be established. And listen carefully. Verse 27, chapter 9. The Jews agreed and made it customary for themselves, their descendants, and all future converts to the Jewish community, Judaism, to continue to celebrate annually without fail these days as specified in the letter on the proper dates. Now, an interesting thing, just as we close here, these days of Purim should never be abrogated among the Jews, verse 28. And that the memory of them should never die among their descendants because of this remarkable delivery that was wrought. And Esther's words fixed these practices for Purim. In other words, it had government authority, as well as already the custom and the general response of the people. You know, there was a time the month Adar could be either the last month of the year, either 29 or 30 days. We're clearly told this in the Talmud. But you and I should know that today the Hebrew calendar allows the month of Adar only to be 29 days. And the months that vary are months 8 and 9, right after the seventh month when the Feast of Tabernacles falls. It didn't used to be that months 8 and 9 were decreed as the variable months. You see, a year may have 353 or 354 or 355 days, so you're bound to have some months where you have two 29s or 29 and 30 or two 30s in a row. It used to be that Adar could vary. That was the logical end of the year. You make the change at the end of the year. But when Purim was decreed, and when, for instance, as an illustration, when the Passover, as this year, would fall on a Sabbath, then the first day, therefore, falls on a Sunday. In other words, Nisan or Abib 1 falls on a Sunday, and the Passover falls on a Sabbath like this year. Let's look at 1981, what would happen. If this year, the Passover, the 14th, of Nisan would fall on a Sabbath, as it does, and the first of Nisan falls on a Sunday, if you have 29 days in Adar, then Purim falls on a Friday. There is no problem. Purim would fall on a Friday. But suppose the Passover were to fall on a Monday, 2 days later, and you would have a situation where the first of Nisan would therefore be a Tuesday. And the 30th of Adar were permitted. And that would be a Monday. Then you would have possibilities, you see, of the month of, the Feast of Purim falling on a Sabbath. There are cases where the Feast of Purim would fall on a Sabbath if we did not have a fixed number of days in the last month of the year, which is 29. On the basis of the calendar, therefore, we have a decision made that we are, in a sense, basing on the book of Esther. The month of Adar must have 29 days and not 30 in order to avoid a problem of having the festival of Purim fall on a Sabbath. You see, the festival of Purim was meant to be celebrated in a very special way that goes beyond the way we normally keep a Sabbath. So even the calendar has been slightly adjusted when it comes to the number of days in a month in order to be sure that this festival occurs in its proper season. And this year it will be a Friday, next Friday. And we're not here, of course, to ask the non-Jewish community to participate. The church does not ask Jews to become uncircumcised. The church does not ask Jews to neglect the requirement of the book of Esther to remember that their ancestors were delivered, as the account is in the book of Esther. And I appreciate an opportunity at a Bible study to discuss this subject and to let us know of its importance from year to year, much as we would convey, if we were Americans in England, something of the meaning of the festival of Thanksgiving to other people, so that we can understand some of the experiences of human beings and what, in this case, the Jewish community has endured. I'm very grateful, too, that I've had the privilege of being in attendance for some years, from time to time, for individuals who have Jewish background, and I have appreciated very much some hearing the prayers and knowing something of the customs that have occurred both at this festival as well as others, such as the festival of Hanukkah or lights that commemorates the story of the deliverance of the Jews in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes. But in any case, you should read, and I'd encourage you to read sometime during this week the book of Esther, and you might like to read some of the background of that book also by looking in the early chapters of Ezra, by looking at the material in Haggai that precedes the story of Esther. It'd give you a feeling of some of the remarkable events that were then transpiring in the kingdom of Judah. And I want to thank the girls for the beautiful work that they did, and Mr. Halford and others in putting together the films. I thought that was a remarkable presentation for some of our young children to do. Have a good night and a safe journey home, and remember the prayer request.